Now on News Talk, as part of our winter season of documentary on News Talk, producer Nuala Macklin puts the spotlight on four remarkable women from Northern Ireland who played an unnoticed but key role in hauling the province back to a point of peace in No Roses Round My Cottage.
So we would have come down here. This is an old country road, and we would have went in, as they called, the back entrance, because we were just the peasants, as they would have called us. Because this is where we would have went in. So on my right, we're just driving past where would have been the main gates into what was the maize prison, which all the combatants would have been in, serving their time. So where you're looking now, well, this housed how many men? In the 80s and the 90s, there was thousands of them, like.
It's no secret how hundreds of Irish women rebels were airbrushed out of the Easter Rising picture. A century later, it's happened again. Not a mention of the women who helped haul Northern Ireland to the point of peace. During the conflict, many women's lives revolved around prison visits. They endured bereavement, isolation, poverty, intimidation, army raids on their homes, riots and bombs in the streets. Yes, the men were in the streets and the ditches with the guns and the bombs and filling the prison cells. Outside in the mayhem, the women fought like demons to hold their families and society together.
My name's Sharon Gibson, I'm 50 years old, and I live in a small village called Donaghcloney, which is in the outskirts of Lurganus, actually County Armagh. I'm a single mum with three kids. I grew up in Donaghcloney, out in a beautiful village. I'm only daughter of Mabel and Freddie, and I was a member of Donaghcloney Girls Brigade for 42 years, Donaghcloney Presbyterian Girls Brigade, and it was where you went, you know, and you did all your games, and you also learned about the Lord Jesus Christ, you know. I think it was 1980, 1981, I met Lewis one night in a wee place called the Belmount, which was the Hunt in Banbridge, where all teenagers went. You know the way you look at him across the floor. I never had any desire that I ever thought I would marry him, because I just wasn't that struck on him there and then, like, you know. But we did. We fell in love, and I married him in 1987. I'd went with him for 7 years before I married him. I thought I knew everything about him, but unfortunately I didn't.
My name is Annie McLean. I was born in the townland of Clocharty in 1936. I grew up with four sisters and four brothers. I went to the local school, and I left there at 14. My father had died sometime before that, and I had to help on the farm.
When you were 14, in the, you know, looking after the cattle and the chickens, when you dreamt about the future, how did you see your life panning out before you?
I saw my life at that time about going abroad. I always wanted to go to Australia. That was my dream. But it never materialised.
Your life was sort of sidetracked.
That's because I fell in love, and I didn't regret one minute of it. At the age of 15, I went to a dance and I met PJ at Love at First Sight. And of course, I was only 15 and a half, and my mother was not going to allow me to go out. But he came in himself and asked, could he take me out to whatever? And then she said that was okay. So that carried on, and we were very happy. And he was teaching at that time in a local school. In 1956, that September, we got engaged. And in 1962, we got married. I went to Belfast, and my niece came with me, and I bought a beautiful dress. a long dress. It was a cream brocade. It was absolutely beautiful. And I had a veil and all the trimmings. We had a beautiful day, weather-wise and every-wise. It was just fantastic. And we had it here in the local church. And we had all the neighbours and all our relations and my sisters and their families came from England. After a lovely day, a great meal and everything else, we went on our honeymoon and we went round Ireland. We spent about 10 days and that was a long time in 1962.
My name's Patsy Lavery and I was born in March 1962 and I grew up in Highfield, which is an area in West Belfast. I had a happy childhood right up to when the troubles began and then just everything started changing. There was Catholics lived in our area, they started being burnt out and other people who I was friends with who were Protestants and lived in Catholic areas were being burnt out. So then it became that people were being put into different Protestant areas and Catholic areas. I had a number of Catholic friends who I would have played with because the Highfield Estate was quite close to Springfield Road. We would have had Catholic neighbours, so we would have played together and then the whole situation changed. My mum's name is Meg, as we call her, but her real name would be Margaret. I suppose at the time, because I had no, my father was in jail and growing up in Highfield, my mum, she did go to work and then when she came in from work, she would have made sure that the house was clean and we had everything. At the time, people were getting fitted kitchens and because we didn't have no money for fitted kitchens, she would have took old units and built them herself and made a whole new working kitchen herself, built from bits and pieces and just bought wood to go over the tops in. And I remember people used to come in and say, let me see the kitchen units that your mum made, because everybody couldn't get over that this woman had made wooden kitchen units herself. In the Protestants, we have so many different churches. If you don't agree with a church or a faith, they set up another church. If you don't agree with a political party, they set up another political party. So I think it's one of them things within us that we are so divided. And I do remember saying to a minister one time, I was talking to him about my faith, well then tell me what church gets me into heaven quicker. And he couldn't answer me.
About 8,000 Loyalist prisoners were jailed over the 30-year conflict. And out of the 15,000 Republican prisoners, it seemed an impossible task for former political prisoner groups to find me a single interviewee. I was repeatedly told, the women want to forget about it, they've nothing to say, and you'll get no one to talk about it. They were right. Through the help of a Belfast community worker, I'd made contact with two very articulate, eager Republican women. Unfortunately, both women withdrew, or perhaps were withdrawn, at the last minute. While speaking to another potential Republican candidate, her husband whipped the phone out of her hand, and I was told to send my questions in writing for his consideration. I'd persisted for months when finally I'd made contact with Brage, a former Republican prisoner, but as a wife, her story is valid and compelling.
My name is Brage Brownlee and I live in West Belfast. I'm one of 11 children who all live around the same area. I have three children and we're a very close-knit family. The first time I met him, Paul was actually running through my mother's back door, hiding from the British Army. And that was my first encounter of him. And after that, then we met up at the disco and met up, you know, like dancing to Tiger Feet and all that sort of stuff. He was always very, very good looking. All the girls fancied him and all the girls were after him. His father was actually shot dead by the IRA by mistake. Apparently he drove up and the IRA man at the roadblock panicked, thought it was an undercover British soldier and shot him dead. That happened when Paul was sort of 14 years of age. The time went on then that Paul, you know, I would see him very little. You know, it was only if he scooted up to see his mummy and see his brother and his sisters. And, you know, I still felt very strong feeling towards him, you know, that, you know, I suppose it's that first love syndrome or whatever, but on when you were 14, 15, you know. Nothing it was like absolutely it. Horrific. From about 1980, we were engaged, and then, you know, a bit. So we ended up, Paul asked me to marry him when he was in Parkhurst Prison. There was no way I was walking into a prison in a white frilly dress. So I was very sensible and got like a nice sort of silvery grey suit. And there was 8 of us allowed in, and there was about 40 prison officers surrounded us in the chapel in Parkhurst Prison. And it was the first wedding ever to take place in Parkhurst Prison, so that's my claim to fame. On the day, somebody sort of gave me this big bouquet of red roses, and it was all wrapped with tinfoil at the bottom. And I thought it was Paul had arranged it, and he was back there, lovely, they're really nice. And then one of the screws came over and he said, "We got you those." I said, "Thank you very much," you know, but it sort of took the gloss off the roses a wee bit. They allowed us to take photographs, and then we had to give them to them to develop. So my wedding photographs, they've like wee squares cut out where all the screws' faces were. You know, so you actually have these wee square photographs with just bodies. And it was quite funny, you know.
So it's 1969 and a horde of Saracen vehicles arrive on your street. You were 9 years old. Can you take me from there?
People would have got outside. Everybody had a metal bin. And people would have got their bin lid, and especially the women would have went outside their front doors and started rattling the bin lids. And you would have heard the whistles going, you would have heard, and you would have lay in bed thinking, are they coming to our house? Where are they going to? Is the noise going further away, or is it coming closer? And if it was coming closer, then you knew that your door was going to get kicked in. And they didn't knock the doors. They didn't knock the door and say, "Can I come in, please?" They used to put their boot to the door and kick it in. I don't know how many new doors my mummy went through over there. It ended up, it was patched, like a patchwork. And then the British soldiers used to just fire up the stairs into all the bedrooms. And all us kids then would have jumped. And you would grab your clothes and try and dress, because you didn't want people to see you, you know, in your pyjamas. And mummy would be herding us all together and saying, you know, put your jumper on and put this on. And there was no central heating or anything in those houses. They were cold, cold, dark houses, you know. And she was only 4'9", but she was a wee firebrand. And mummy would have come down, and there was the old coal fire. And she used to light the coal fire. And she'd build it up and build it up and build it up and build it up until it was roaring, roaring hot. Because the soldiers were standing there in all their gear, and their padded jackets and their helmets and their gear, and they were holding their guns, and they had their backpacks, and the sweat used to be lashing off them. And then if mummy used to stick the pan on then, and she'd stick a load of bacon and all in the pan, and she'd give us all, and we would be sitting all crouched around this fire, maybe with a bacon buddy, sitting eating it, you know.
What time of night would
you're talking be? 4 o'clock in the morning. 4 o'clock in the morning, you're talking, this is what happened. And my mummy used to just keep it going, you know, and she'd say, you know, she hated, this was an invasion, this was an armed force coming into a wee kitchen house in West Belfast, and 9 children in it, you know. And that was the way my mummy coped with it.
Through the eyes of a child, the mayhem seemed like an adventure.
It was terrifying, but it also, because you're a young girl and you see the army coming into the area, these are people from outside the area, and you see it as being like a sort of a camping trip as well. You see people, although there was the battles going on and there was difficulties out there was people being murdered and different things like that, but as a young person, you sort of blacked that out and you made it adventurous. You just seen it as a camping trip, and we were safe because we were further down in the area and we didn't need to be put out of our houses. And I used to think, oh, I want to go into that door, that school, to be able to camp out the night. Then people are in there camping out. And I suppose that's because you were a young person and you just seen it as that, and you didn't see the bad side of it, like that there was danger in it, and then people were being put in there for a reason.
A snapshot of the background to the Troubles would show Northern Ireland in 1969 being rocked by intense rioting. Civil rights campaigners wanted an end to discrimination against Catholics. Scores of houses, businesses and factories were burned out, and thousands of mostly Catholic families were driven from their homes. When the British Army was deployed to restore order, this was seen as the start of the 30-year conflict. Enter the Provisional IRA, who saw its role to protect the Catholic minority community. The Ulster Defence Association was established to defend loyalist areas from attacks by nationalist paramilitaries. Angered by the implications of a new reform programme, the Ulster Volunteer Force believed that the ideal future lay in turning back the clock to the days of absolute unionist control.
At that time, the IRA was seen as our only saviour, and we would have said, what can we do? How can we help? It was either hiding under your bed, absolutely bloody terrified, and coming out of it a neurotic wreck, or actually playing your part in to try and sort of secure your areas.
Far from having passive roles, many women carried weapons and messages. Some took part in major operations, while others cared for the injured, provided safe houses, and organised parades, demonstrations and petitions to seek an end to the violence.
When I first joined the IRA, I was sent on little missions, maybe carrying messages, maybe carrying, you know, sort of missives between different areas and stuff. I sort of ended up carrying weapons from area to area, and I ended up getting caught with incendiary devices.
I'll tell you about the morning they came for PJ. We had 8 children and I was expecting the 9th, and PJ was arrested on the morning of the 9th of August. On the night before, my mother was very ill in hospital, and him and my brother went down to stay with her for a while in the hospital. So they came home in the early hours, and at 6:30, the banging was at our door. So PJ went down in his pyjamas, and the army just burst in and all through the house, and he went back up the stairs, and they came all up the stairs after him. The children were crying. I was distressed. And he, when they were down the stairs, I was trying to pull him back up again, and they were pulling him down. They were very rough and very, very... not good behaviour. About an afternoon of that day, some of the family came and said my mother had died. And that was so traumatic. I didn't know where to turn to. He was away, I didn't know where, and she had died. And the children were all so small, they couldn't help me in any way. And the funeral was then in 2 days' time. I couldn't go to the funeral because I was still waiting on a phone call to see where he was or what was happening, or waiting on him to come home. And it must have been 6 or 7 days we got word that he was in Crumlin Road prison.
PJ McLean, civil rights activist and school teacher, was interned for 9 months without trial.
When I sat then after, you know, everything that happened to me and thought about it, there were signs, but I never picked them up. Never. I was just stupid. I was this 24-year-old girl in my new wee house, just got married, just had a wee baby, and my world was perfect. On the 6th of March 1989, my world fell apart. On the Wednesday morning at 25 minutes past five, on our front door, and whenever we looked out, the whole street was cordoned off. It was the Ulster Constabulary. Whenever everything did come to light, Lewis had been in the UDA, which is the Ulster Defence Association, for many of years, and I knew nothing about it, and I really didn't. They came in, and the Red Lewis's rights, while they racked, as the saying goes, our house. I wouldn't call it searched, because they don't search the racket. Gemma was sleeping, lying in her cot, and I can remember the policewoman coming up the stairs to me, and she says to me, where's your child? And I said, she's sleeping. Lift her. I said, I'm not lifting my baby out of her sleep. And she says, you are lifting your baby out of her sleep. She says, because it's not the first time we have found a gun under a sleeping baby. About 3 hours later, I didn't panic. I got my daughter ready. I took her to the childminder. I got into my car and I went to my work, and I never phoned one. I thought I could deal with it myself, but I couldn't. I worked for the Ministry of Defence in Charles Street in Portadown, which was TA. And I was the secretary in their typing pool. I loved my job. I was there before I married Lewis. I was sitting in my work on the Wednesday, and our RSAM came in, Regimental Sergeant Major. And he says to me, Sharon, what has happened? Because he says the police are downstairs. He says, and they want to interview you. They actually arrested me and took me to Gough Barracks. And I was in Gough Barracks for about 24 hours. They took me hoping that they would get Lewis to talk, and it worked. Lewis was charged with murder, and it was actually a guy he worked with. He was in remand in the Crumlin Road prison for 18 months before they went to trial. There was three of them all up together, charged with the one murder. Two of them pleaded guilty, and Lewis pleaded not guilty. Lewis was found guilty. My former friends made life very difficult for me. They made me feel as if it was me, and it wasn't me. One former friend rang me, and she said to me, is it true? And are you going to stick by him? And I said, at this stage, I don't know whether I'm living or dead. And that was the last I ever heard tell of her.
40 years on, Patsy clearly remembers the night of her father's arrest.
I was 11, just going under 12, and I can remember him being out that night and then coming in, and then he wasn't too long in the house whenever we heard banging on our door, and our door was put in, and the police and the army came and searched the house, and my father was lifted. It was very scary. He was charged with murder, so he was. He murdered a man, and he got a life sentence for it.
I remember one time walking up to the top of the road, there's a chip shop, and I hadn't seen Paul in a while, and one of his friends said, did you hear what happened to him? And here's me, why, what's happened? And I immediately thought, my God, he's dead, because so many people, you know, there were so many deaths all around. And he said, no, he's been arrested in England. So it turned out Paul had gone to England with an IRA squad. This was in 1976. And at the time he was 17 years of age, you know. And it ended up a policeman or somebody recognised them and questioned them. And it ended up there was a gun battle in a restaurant. And Paul shot a policeman, but he didn't die. You know, thank God he didn't die. He was given 5 life sentences plus 20 years.
You're listening to No Roses Round My Cottage on News Talk 106 to 108.
Completely unprepared for what she would find, Annie made her way to Crumlin Jail to see PJ.
There was a huge door at the front, and you had to wait to be let in. Then there was a big iron gate. You had to wait till they were opened. Then you walked along a corridor. There was more gates, and eventually you got in, but you couldn't touch the person. There was a grill. and you spoke through a grill. And he was in an awful battered state, his face cut. He was so thin. To me, it seemed like he had lost a few stone weight. It was unbelievable. So it was absolutely just awful. It was very sad to see the state he was in, but his mind was very clear and he was in reasonably good form of talking. Later on, I suppose you could say it got very famous, because with 11 other men, they took a case to Strasbourg. The picture emerged that really the treatment they got there was torture. Their heads were covered all the time, and one time he said the mask slipped and he could see these big able-bodied men. They would make them stand at the walls on their toes and their hands up against the wall until they would nearly just fall down. And they would be kicked and beaten, deprived of any food. They got water at odd time. The noise was something like a helicopter, very piercing. It affected their head and their ears, this piercing noise that was going on all the time in that torture centre. He was brought to Crumlin Road jail, and that's what it ended for him. Well, I was suffering because every time you would think of him, especially the week that I didn't know where he was, I wasn't sleeping. And then when I heard what happened to him, it was so heartbreaking. It was unbelievable. It was just so terrible to have to live with that, to think that he had to come through all that for nothing, that he wasn't to blame for anything. Because he spoke out at civil rights meetings, fair play for everybody was his motto. Justice for everybody. It was very hard. I was running the house, looking after the children, trying to buy what I could, and I had no money from the state. I couldn't have got through it without my faith. I really couldn't.
We were living in a war zone. There was no such thing as normality. You know, normal to us was being arrested. Normal to us, you know, was the contents of your school bag being thrown out on the street. It was your father, your brothers being arrested continually. It was being woken up in the early hours of the morning with British soldiers. One of the scariest moments, I feel like, that I often think of, my curfew, I had to be in the house for 10 o'clock, but of course I was a wee rebel. It was about 11 o'clock. I was coming up the Falls Road to come home. And at that time I had my hair cut very short, and we all wore these cut-off trousers, the wide denim Skinner trousers and the boots and the sipped-up Gilbert jumpers. We all thought we were gorgeous. My God, when you think of it now, we were awful. There's a big wall along the Falls Road at what used to be an old nursing home. And as I was walking up one night, about 10:45 it was, a car came down the Falls Road, and as the car came towards me, it slowed down. And I got really worried. And I was walking, trying to walk faster and faster, but I was nearly hugging the wall. The car came slower and slower, and as it got parallel to me, the windows were down, and all I saw was the guns sticking out of the windows, and I just froze. It was four men in the car, they all had guns, but there were two guns out the passenger door and the back door, and then I heard one of them shout, "It's a girl, it's a girl." And that night they drove off then, they just sped on down the Falls Road, and I took to my heels and I thought, how lucky am I? The next morning there was a man called Mr. Donegan, and Mr. Donegan was the last victim of the Shankill Butchers, who were a gang of loyalists roaming the streets, killing people. You know, that was my childhood.
As a child, Patsy recalls the visits to the prison to see her father.
I went to visit him as often as I could, and I remember I used to, in fact, love going on the visits to visit him, because he would have came down with his wee brown paper bag, and in this paper bag he would have had loads of bars of chocolate and different things for us. You would have went in your visit where you would have got searched. As children, you get searched, and you had to open your mouth and make sure you had nothing in your mouth and everything. You would have went in, and my father would have been sitting waiting on us in a wee closed room, and then this closed room would have been a sort of a desk with one chair facing us and two chairs on the other opposite side, and then there would have been a prison officer standing behind him, just watching to make sure that there was no smuggling. So it was hard in that way, seeing these people watching you and staring at you, and you sort of thought they were laughing at you more or less, so it was hard that way.
I had said to my parents, you know, that I was going over, and they weren't a bit happy about it, you know, go to Dirty England. And I explained to them, you know, well, I think I need to go over and see Paul, you know, see, make sure he's okay. But nothing prepared me for that journey over, you know. A typical visit to go over to see Paul would be leaving here in the early hours of the morning and getting on a boat. And the boats then, you know, would have taken like maybe 14 hours to get to Liverpool. You got on a train, and it was another day travelling most of the day down from Liverpool to London. When Paul was on the Isle of Wight, that was even worse, because you had to go the whole way through England, basically, right down, over, get the hovercraft then over to the Isle of Wight. The whole connections, if you missed one connection, you had to wait maybe 4 hours for the next. And then there was part of the train that actually split when you were going to the Isle of Wight. So you had to make sure you were on the right end of the train. And all those things, you used to have it in your head, and you used to think, now watch the end of the train, watch this, watch that, watch the other. And, you know, you had to gauge everything. For most of the years I went to England, I travelled alone instead in B&B. I think that cured me of B&Bs for life. I haven't stayed in one since. I hate them. Hate B&Bs.
With Lewis now in prison, Sharon gets on with her life sentence, which now would revolve around weekly prison visits.
Lewis was the one that was sentenced to the life sentence, but I did it with him. All the way. I lost my friends. I had to struggle to put a loaf on the table. My kids got a day in a caravan in Portrush, and all their friends was going to Disney World, or, you know, all those different things. It was all the everyday chores that I had to do on my own. The guys were the ones that were sitting in there doing the life sentence, but the women did it on the outside, because they had to keep everything together and have something for the men to come out to. I'm not saying they didn't have a care in the world. They had no commitments when they were inside. They weren't committed to anything. Whereas we did. The insurances had to be paid, the rates had to be paid, the car. You know, if there was tyres needed put in the car, well, I had to find that money to put those tyres in the car. Lewis was inside, and the ones that was left on the outside, we were trying to put together the pieces and think, why? You know, why did he do it? Why did this happen to us? Why has he put us in this situation? You know, for instance, the guy who Lewis was charged with, how could I ever think of how his family went through that, and it was my husband that was charged for it? And sometimes that made me sick, trying to even think, you know, and then I just had to put it out of the back of my head, and I had to think, you know, your family now, you have to try and be strong now, because them guys were in jail, and there were these big, hard men. They were in their world, together in their world, because they were all in there. But I was outside on my own. I was mummy. I was daddy. I had to buy his clothes. I had to put money in his tuck shop. I had to leave him in his parcels. I had all that to do while he sat in there with not a care in the world. I think once Lewis was sentenced, you know, it was final. I just had to get on with it. There was no choice in the matter. You know, this was it. He got life. Get on with it, Garrett, because there's nothing else you can do, you know. You have to get on with it. I used to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, pull mushrooms. I did anything that would come bring money in. You're going to laugh at this one now.
Lewis's mum passed away, unfortunately. He was allowed out on special leave for a day, but he got out for 24 hours for his mum's funeral. So while he was home, I got pregnant and I got twins. I was lucky. At that stage, I mightn't have thought I was. You know, I mightn't have thought I was, but I was, you know. I was very, very lucky. The shock, one, to find out that you're pregnant and your husband's in jail. The next shock was to find out that there was two and your husband was in jail. But God works in mysterious ways.
He came out of jail 15 years later, and I was a married woman then. He wasn't even allowed a day release to go to the wedding. My oldest brother had to give me away the day of my wedding. So it was very sad for him coming out of jail, because he still pictured me as being a young girl, and now I was a married woman and I had three children of my own. I got married in 1981 actually, when I was 19. We have nine children now, so we do. In 1983, my husband went to prison under the word of a supergrass, and he did 2 years in remand. A supergrass is a person who is charged with something, and in order that he gets a more lighter sentence, he then informs on other people. My husband was innocent. He was on remand for 2 years, and after the 2 years, he was released. I suppose took things for granted where I didn't think it was as hard for my mum. And I suppose being in the same situation, you then realise how difficult it was for a mother and a wife for whenever their husbands were in jail. And I suppose at the time it was very hard because I was running to jail to visit my dad. I was going to jail to visit my husband three times a week. And then at that stage my brother was also in jail. So I was running to three different jails, maybe in a week. Sometimes I was going to Longcash to visit my dad to the Crumlin Road prison when my husband was on remand, and then my brother was in McGarry prison, which is down towards Derry, Londonderry. My brother was sentenced for 7 years, so he was on a robbery charge. Pardon. I never promised you a rose garden along with the sunshine.
There's gotta be a little rain sometime. Patsy remembers how tough it was for her mother Meg to keep her family safe.
She would have just been a mother and just getting on with doing her work. So she would have ensured that we had our dinners on the table. It was very hard for her at the beginning. She was a mother of six children, five sons. And at that time, it was the beginning of the troubles. Young fellows were trying to get involved and stone thrown and different things as they seen it protecting their community. So it was hard for her to try and make sure that her sons didn't get involved in that, didn't join any paramilitary organisations. But given the area that we came from, that was very, I suppose, hard. And our community became under siege and we were attacked nightly. At times we had to black our windows and blacken our curtains because the area would have got shot at and different things like that. And at this stage, my father's mother had started to go sort of senile, so we had to let her move into our house as well. And my granny didn't like to be out of her own house and living in a house full of children, because it was hard for her as well, and on a number of occasions was found wandering outside of the house by the army and brought home in her nightdress. And so it was hard for my mum because she was trying to rear six children. She was having to go to jail. She was trying to keep, I suppose, part-time work going at the time and then having to look after an older woman. So it was very hard for her. Money was a big issue, so it was. We had to probably go without Christmas presents at Christmas when you seen other people being able to go out and buy stuff. And we maybe got hand-me-downs and different things like that. But I think at that time, it wasn't just us, because of the community you came from, and there was a lot of people who supposed didn't have no money, so you did go without, but you had good neighbours who also made sure that if we didn't have no food, that they maybe sent you over some dinner and stuff like this. So it was a kind of a neighbourhood where people would have looked out for you and made sure that you were eating and everything was okay.
Patsy says the women weren't trying to be heroes or look for praise.
It was the women who run the jails. It was the women who kept the families together. For instance, when the men were being scalded in the jails, it was the women who went to protest with the government to be able to get them segregation. It was the women who, whenever the BBC was holding back and didn't allow people to talk, it was the women who protested outside the news stations to make sure that the men were able to have their say. There's a lot of women who would have supported the paramilitaries. There was a lot of women who, whenever there was any fighting going on, if people were injured, they would have, suppose during stone throwing or rubber bullets, they would have held them in a medical way, but didn't want people to know that, so they didn't. They just got on with doing them bits and pieces and that was it. I suppose it was because women just seen it as their role to do it and not to get a pat on the back. I mean, they'd done it because they wanted to do it, not because they were told to do it. They didn't do it for a bunch of flowers or anything like that. I'm coming home, I've done
my time. After years of independent living, Sharon tells how the homecoming brought a whole new set of challenges.
It was probably harder getting used to him being home again than it was when he went away. But he came home again. I was like a stranger in my house. I had slept in a bed of my own for 11 and a half years. If my friends came to my house, they just opened the door and walked on in. You know, I had now to resolve to the fact of, it was like looking after another child. Another child coming into the house, because you had to be there to cook the dinner and you had to be there, you know, and this was a stranger getting into my bed. A stranger in my wee world. And it was so hard. And then you had the fact of this stranger to these three kids. They seen him once a week. But who was it? He was a man that sat across the table and brought me down a packet of sweets. You know, he wasn't there on Christmas morning. He wasn't there whenever I was opening my birthday presents. He didn't take me to school. He didn't take me to the GB. He didn't take me to the BB. And now he was telling me what to do. I could chastise the kids, you know, don't do that. You're not allowed to do that. Or if they asked me, you know, could they go somewhere? No, you can't go, or you can, or whatever. But now there was another person back into the house.
Being in a constant state of hypervigilance throughout the conflict took its toll on women's health, which carries over to the present day. Many turned to prescription drugs and alcohol to help them cope. An ugly part of the post-conflict legacy is the serious ongoing issue of domestic and sexual violence. Viewed glibly by some as a stress response, this criminal behaviour in no way excuses former prisoners having difficulty adjusting to life outside jail. Sadly, Bridget's suffering didn't end with Paul's release.
Just when you think life is sort of becoming very good and life, oh, that's the jail behind us, that's everything gone, it's all roses from now on. We'd always hoped during the years that we would have a life together and that eventually we would have kids. But we had never sort of thought that we would lose three children. Unfortunately, through the years then, you know, I started to see that Paul was drinking more than he should have. It was when I left then to move to this house with the kids that Paul turned violent. It was Christmas Day, and I had the table all set for the Christmas dinner and kids' toys all over the floor and stuff. And as soon as I saw that he had drink on him, I asked him to leave. He became very abusive, so I phoned the police. And he grabbed the phone off me, threw me across the table and threatened all sorts. He was going to burn the house down. 4 days after Christmas, one of the neighbours knocked my door and said, "Bridget, your car's on fire." And he told me, "What?" And I looked at it. He had petrol bombed the car. Because Paul was out on licence, he was arrested and he spent then a year in McGabbery prison. When Paul got out of prison, we went to a lovely wee thatch cottage in Donegal for our honeymoon. Fantastic time. We loved Donegal, we loved the cottage. And we actually ended up buying that cottage. And outside it, there were roses, wild roses, that have been growing there for decades and decades. And we had great, great hopes of that cottage and of that, you know, that was symbolic of where we wanted to be. But we hadn't realised there were so many thorns among them, you know, and we've certainly had our share of thorns.
The day Annie and her children had been praying for finally arrived.
The children were down at the hall and the door opened and Father Dennis Fall came in. He always was the chaplain for the Long Cage, and here PJ come in behind him, and we didn't know that he was coming. So, wonderful surprise. So all the children were there, and the new baby that they'd never seen. She was 7 months old and just lovely age, and it was a very happy day.
Annie now lives in happy retirement, while dedicated peace builders Patsy, Breege and Sharon continue to reach out across the sectarian divide.
I started to work with loads of different women from loads of different backgrounds. Not one of them any different than GR. We all wanted the same. We were all working for the same, and we were just the same. The biggest one that I was amazed, they couldn't believe that, you know, the police came in, racked our houses, searched our houses and did to us exactly what they did to them. Everybody went through exactly the same hell.
No Roses Round My Cottage was produced by Nuala Macklin and was supported by a grant from the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland as part of the Sound and Vision Scheme.